Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with architectural historian Ellen Weiss, whose new book is Robert R. Taylor and Tuskegee, An African-American Architect Designs for Booker T. Washington. And poet Andy Young tells us about her new collection, The People is Singular. Dr. Ellen Weiss is a professor emerita of architecture in the Tulane University School of Architecture. Her new book is a fascinating study of the first African-American graduate of MIT. Its title is Robert R. Taylor in Tuskegee, An African-American Architect Designs for Booker T. Washington. Welcome to The Reading Life, Ellen.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Robert Taylor lived from 1868 to 1942. Could you tell us a little bit about him?
Well, he was the son of a slave, a more almost free slave, a slave whose white father, owner father, gave him permission to go off into Wilmington, North Carolina, the big city, and earn his own keep, which he did very well. And this legal slave got the competency to put all four of his children through higher education, or at least some higher education. His youngest, Robert R., went to MIT from Wilmington, North Carolina in 1888 and graduated therefrom in 1892 with a degree in architecture.
Wow. And how did you first become interested in his work?
I was living in East Central Alabama, very near Tuskegee, and I would go over there and look at it. I was fascinated by the place. And then I heard that a black architect had designed it. Well, I'm an architectural historian. I'd never heard of a black architect of any historical significance. And I thought, that is a story that has to be told.
So were you drawn to him first by his story or by the buildings he created?
By the buildings. Mm-hmm. I would have worked on them anyway and just published it locally.
And what was special about them to you?
They're beautifully scaled. They're Colonial Revival, which is right for the period of the 1890s through 1915. Actually, he can talk later about how long this goes on. But anyway, for that period, they're graceful. They're beautifully proportioned. They're inventive in some wonderful ways that I think are absolutely personal to this particular architectural artist at this moment. I quite fell in love with the buildings. If he were merely black and I didn't like the buildings, I wouldn't have done the project. The fact that he was black, that just made it a great mystery, which I had to go into.
And you spent time at Tuskegee doing research. What was that like?
Oh, wonderful. It's another world. And I had wonderful experiences there. I got to know some very fine people, including some who were aware that this was historical, but they didn't realize how historical it was. Worked in the archives until, unfortunately, the archives were closed for 5 years for a critical period. But I also spent time in the basement of Howard Tilton Library at Tulane, where the wonderful interlibrary loan people got for me the correspondence between Robert R. Taylor and Booker T. Washington. This is on microfilm. It's held at the Library of Congress, and it's on microfilm. And I went through other things on microfilm at Howard Tilton.
So one of the things that fascinated me about Tuskegee is that I didn't realize that so much of it was actually built by its students.
Yes.
And I was talking to a friend about that this morning, and she seemed puzzled by it as well. But it's a fascinating story, isn't it?
It's self-build, which is not that unusual in the 19th century. And now we would, of course, call it design build. We at Tulane have an excellent program where students have the experience of actually constructing buildings. And it's something that students can use. Mind you, this is not just training students to be architects. In fact, that's kind of a minor part of it. But to train them in the building trades and in other trades. Tuskegee was a secondary school during Booker T. Washington's era. And it was meant to bring people of unimaginable poverty in, from mm-hmm. our experience into the mainstream, get them into the middle class, and use whatever trade skills they could teach them to get them there. And all of the building trades were a large part of it, so they would practice. Mm-hmm. On construction. We call it work study now.
You have this wonderful photograph of the students there with pens in hand trying to estimate the number of bricks in a wall.
Oh, yes.
I mean, just right out there doing it.
Well, that's another dimension. It was also a normal school. And so you're training teachers according to very progressive educational thought of the period. So those students will be learning to teach, and what they're doing is learning the interaction of what you can count, what you can measure, what you can compute, and how all of this works together, because they're going to go out and teach arithmetic mm-hmm. using maybe little blocks to represent bricks.
Right.
It's all one.
Mm-hmm. Now, what did you learn about the architect-client relationship writing this book? Because Robert Taylor has such a special client in Booker T. Washington.
Oh, yes, he does. He's a very wise client. Booker T. Washington knew nothing. He managed to get himself, you know, sleeping under sidewalks and just walking, you know, with these horrendous arrival tales, to Hampton Institute in about 1870. But Hampton, which was founded by whites, staffed by whites, led by whites, had a very good, very famous white architect design its building. Richard Morris Hunt mm-hmm. designed a number of buildings at Hampton. And Booker T. was there, and he could see what an architect can do. He could see how essential an architect is to the creation of a place, to the creation of an institution and its identity, both to an identity that will be perceived by the people who live there and by mm-hmm. outsiders who come there. He wanted that for his school, Tuskegee. Tuskegee's an offshoot of Hampton. But Booker T. was going to do it with all black teachers, all black staffing, all black talent, all the way around, because he was going to show to the watching world black capability.
Mm-hmm.
So he ran out, he had a hard time getting them, but he eventually got the first professionally trained or academically trained African-American architect to come be his Richard Morris Hunt.
Mm-hmm.
That was Taylor.
Now, a big part of your book is a painstaking catalog of the buildings at Tuskegee. Tell us why this is important.
Well, I think when you consider a place, you have to consider each building has its own story in a way. Now, at Tuskegee, the client relationship is a little complex because, yes, it's Booker T. Washington, but it's also the individual donors of the buildings. Almost every building was funded by a different, usually white, usually northern, philanthropically minded donor. And they had their ideas too. And the correspondence is fascinating because you see Taylor, Booker T., and the various donors kind of juggling things. Some donors just said, oh, just, you know, make it a nice building. But other donors really wanted to get involved.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of a complex thing. And to tell that story, you have to kind of do it building by building.
Mm-hmm.
Each building has its own narrative. It's a way of kind of getting in like close focus or close action, in close to the action, mm-hmm. when you consider each building with its own narrative. So that's why it's a little bit separate. And there's main text, and then there's the catalog with the separate stories for each building.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting. I mean, he was such an innovator and such a family man, and he lived such a large life, you know, traveled to Africa, did
yes.
all these things, and then he died in one of his own buildings.
Yes. He had went back to Wilmington when he retired, and he had another 10 years, and he was active in trying to get, say, New Deal programs for the black population of Wilmington. But his daughter was married in Tuskegee and stayed there. She was married to a Tuskegee doctor. Mm-hmm. So he came often to visit her. And he was in his chapel. And I've heard the story from his granddaughter, who was about 8 years old at the time. And she said he was standing there looking at his chapel. And he said, "This is my masterpiece." And he collapsed.
Wow. That's an amazing end to a life.
Yes, it is.
We've been talking with Dr. Ellen Weiss about her new book, Robert R. Taylor in Tuskegee, An African-American Architect, Designs for Booker T. Washington. You can meet her Thursday, January 26th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Poet Andy Young is the co-editor of Nina, a bilingual Arabic-English literary journal based in Alexandria, Egypt, and in New Orleans. She also teaches creative writing at the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts. Her most recent book is The People is Singular, a collection of poems about the Egyptian Revolution, a collaboration with photographer Salwa Rashad. Hi, Andy. Welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, Susan.
This struggle in Egypt is very personal for you, isn't it?
It really is. As you mentioned, I'm the co-editor of a bilingual journal based there as well as in New Orleans. So I have a lot of friends there. I have family in Egypt because I'm married to an Egyptian poet. So I'm involved on a personal level because I'm always worried about my friends there. And I'm involved just as a person, I think, because I care so much about the struggle.
Mm-hmm. And how are things with Mina? You've just published your third issue.
The third issue came out over a year ago now, actually, and we're still working to get it out there. We're independent, as you know, so we don't have a big distribution situation. We're just trying to do it by hand, and I'm very proud of the issue. A lot of great people are in it, and now we have to think of what the next one will be, kind of post-revolution.
Mm-hmm. And it's truly a labor of love.
It really is. It really is, yeah.
So now we have this new book, The People is Singular. What inspired you to take on this project with Salwa Rashad?
Well, I began writing poems last January when the revolution began. And I guess, like most of my poems, they came from a place of just trying to understand what was going on, trying to understand in myself how I felt, having this kind of overwhelming feeling of helplessness, really watching the events unfold. So the poems tend to spring from that place for me a lot of the time. So I started writing these poems, and then I spoke with Anne Gisselson at Press Street Press. They were looking to do a third in their series of beautiful chapbooks that are collaborations with visual artists. And I was in touch with Salwa Rashad, and I'm friends with her. She's a professional photographer based in Alexandria. And I'd been looking at her photos, seeing kind of the human face of the revolution in conjunction with trying to follow the news. And it just worked really nicely that she had these photos from inside the revolution because she takes part in it and she's photographing it from inside. And then here I am on the outside trying to make sense of it. And they just seemed to, the poems and the photos spoke very nicely together. And Press Street was nice enough to give it a shot and put it together and see what it looked like.
And Press Street is a New Orleans publisher, we should say.
Yes.
Also. And Anne Gisselson is a colleague of yours at NOCA.
She is. Indeed.
And also, I was curious to ask you, did you write certain poems inspired by the photographs? Did that dialogue inform your writing as well?
Salwa and I talked about that early on, and we decided to keep our work separate. I mean, it's hard to know all of the influences in a poem, so I'm sure somewhere those faces that she's shown me mm-hmm. have worked their way into the poems. But for the most part, we didn't try to pair poems and photos, but instead tried to have these separate experiences juxtaposed.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that from the very beginning, you envisioned this as something kind of larger than just a book. I mean, this event that we're about to talk about is a big thing Wednesday night to launch the book.
Yes. I guess I don't know at what point that came about, but the idea of the revolution beginning really in Tunisia, and then I think coming more into the world's consciousness with Egypt and seeing how that has blossomed throughout the world so mm-hmm. that, you know, now it's continuing. It's really a global uprising now. Something about that and about the kind of populist nature of revolution made me think this isn't just about a poet in a room of poets reading poems. Mm-hmm. It just felt like it needed to have different ways to enter the experience and explore the experience of the revolution.
So tell us what you have planned for the 25th.
On the 25th, we're going to be at Cafe Istanbul in the Healing Center, and I will certainly be reading the poems and reciting the poems, but there will also be music. Tao Seeger is kind of spearheading the music, and Al Sara, a Sudanese singer, is coming in from New York. And a few other folks, a flamenco guitarist John Lawrence will be involved, percussionist Dave Sobel. And the music, I think, is bringing in that kind of global aspect that right. I was talking about. Their Tao comes from a line of tremendous history of American protest music as the grandson of Pete Seeger. And so he grew up with this sensibility. He plays the banjo. He grew up with the sensibility, I think, of revolution. And in fact, grew up in Nicaragua during the revolution there. So he's bringing to it, his one song is going to be a Spanish Civil War song. There are going to be some American protest music about coal mining, which gets me back to my background from West Virginia. Uh-huh. So that's very exciting for me. And then as well as some Egyptian music. So the music really brings in that global nature. Then Courtney Keller is going to be doing some video projections, and she's an experimental video artist. She's an amazing artist, and she's helping me to bring in that sense of the visual nature of these poems. So much of the revolution I experienced through screens, mm-hmm. and so much of the inspiration for the revolution, I think, on the ground has been through the internet. That's how people have communicated. A lot of the plans and a lot of the inspiration came through social media. So I'm trying to acknowledge that through mm-hmm. some of the visual nature of the show. And then, of course, Selwa's photos will be on the wall. We're even going to have some dance. Earl Cyano's going to do some soundscapes. So I'm trying to get to all of the senses of trying to experience this tremendous time, really, we're living through.
Mm-hmm. And you turned to Kickstarter to raise funds for this enterprise. How did that work out for you? More and more artists are doing that.
I had never done it before, but it's really kind of amazing because we were successful in our campaign to, you know, raise enough money to do this so we could, for example, bring El Sara down from New York. What's amazing about it, I think, is that it also fits really nicely with the themes of the show and the poems because people invest in the project. So it's not just people donating, but people get things back like books, like copies of the book or a ticket to the show, various other kind of lagniappes. But I hope that there are 71 backers out there, mm-hmm. and I hope that all 71 feel invested in what we're doing. And it's that sense of people kind of believing in what you're doing that is inspirational as well as making it practically possible.
It's a tremendous validation. It really is. So I wonder if you'd read one of your poems from The People is Singular for us.
Sure. I'll read the poem that, in fact, is the title poem that you'll hear at the end. And this is called Mubasher, which means live, as in live broadcast in Arabic. In the dark, a white-lit screen, water cannons spraying praying people on Qasr al-Nil Bridge, humans shielding mummies, books, Akhenaten. Which way will the army go? Chanting pours through my husband's laptop. Selmaya, Selmaya, peaceful, peaceful, he says. The screen shows screens in Tahrir gone black, the square itself black except for the flashes. Should we mute the sound of gunshots? Ishap, Yuri, Ishap, Yuri, what the hell does it mean? The people want the fall of the you say, they say, the people want bread. The barrier between us and our president was broken by tear gas, says a man in the news who cannot mute, cannot shut the screen to tear gas. A fog from this distance, up close, the canisters, expired dates, made in USA, etched in metal, in Arabic, the people is singular, which does not translate.
Thank you, Andy. That's an amazing poem.
Thank you.
You can meet Andy Young and many of her friends Wednesday night, January 25th at 7 p.m. at Cafe Istanbul in the New Orleans Healing Center, 2372 St. Charles Avenue. And be sure to check out minamag.com.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Andy Young and friends present a multimedia book launch for her poetry collection, The People is Singular, with photographs by Salwa Rashad, Wednesday, January 25th at 7 p.m. at Cafe Istanbul in the Healing Center, 2372 St. Claude Avenue. Tickets are available at the door. Today's guest, architectural historian Ellen Weiss, discusses and signs Robert R. Taylor in Tuskegee, an African-American architect designs for Booker T. Washington, Thursday, January 26th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, January 29th at 3 p.m. at the Maple Leaf Bar. Nevada Barr discusses and signs her new Anna Pigeon thriller, The Rope, Monday, January 30th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. And here's something new in the reading life. If you've ever had a fantasy about giving things away or giving books away, this might be for you. World Book Night is an annual celebration designed to spread the love of reading and books. It's been held in the United Kingdom before, and this year it will be held in the United Kingdom, in Ireland, and in the United States. On that night, April 23rd, thousands of people will go out into their communities to spread the joy of reading by giving out free World Book Night paperbacks. If you'd like to be a book giver, or if you'd like to find out more information, check out the website worldbooknight.org, which also lists the 30 books for World Book Night. The deadline to register to be a giver is February 1st, so apply soon. Major support for The Reading Life is provided by Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and from the estate of Dr. Judith Bradow. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.